Paris under lockdown again. Can't leave the house at night. Some epidemiologists say France needs new tests, not curfews.
We're losing so much money. Closing bars, closing restaurants, having no tourists. I mean, it's just a major catastrophe.
Also today, an app that is helping Inuit communities adapt to climate change.
It's time for the harpoon and the computer to work together.
And Germany is paying hundreds of millions of dollars to Holocaust survivors who are struggling during the pandemic.
I don't think the coronavirus has anything to do with the Holocaust. But on the other hand, I think the German people are responsible for all the survivors, for their well-being.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We start the show today in a country that has been racked by war since 2011, but does not get a lot of attention, Yemen. This week, two Americans and the final remains of a third were released by Yemen's Houthi government, according to an agreement reached between the U.S. and Yemen. On the same day, about 240 Houthis, originally captured by Saudi Arabia, were allowed to return to Yemen. Stephen Sesh was U.S. ambassador to Yemen during the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He joins us now. We're talking about American Sandra Lowley, an aid worker, and Mikhail Jadada, a businessman. Ambassador, you were in the Foreign Service for 35 years, three of those years in Yemen. What do you make of the news that the U.S. arranged for the release of these American hostages?
Well, I think it's a very good day for the United States when we can bring back two of our citizens and at least the remains of a third who passed away in Houthi captivity. Certainly in terms of our president, it's a good day for him because of his proximity now to elections and his commitment to bringing Americans home. I think the Houthis can declare victory in this case because they've gotten back a number of their fighters, some of whom are apparently well trained in certain specific instances that will be helpful to them in the battlefield. I think the big losers here are probably Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia had to make a lot of concessions and it didn't want to do this. It didn't want to release the fighters. It had to open up the airport in Sana'a that it controls in order to bring them back. So I think in the long run, I think that if the Houthis and the U.S. seem to walk away from this with certain gains, the Saudis can point to very little.
I avoided calling this a swap. The U.S. National Security Advisor stopped short of describing an exchange of hostages, but did thank Saudi King Salman and Omani Sultan Haitham bin Tariq Al Said for their efforts to secure the release of our citizens. What do you think? Was this likely a prisoner swap?
Well, I don't have any doubt that I think that it wouldn't have happened if each side didn't have, you know, individuals that the other wanted.
Give us a little background on the Houthis. Who are they? And was it public knowledge that they were holding these Americans?
Well, the Houthis go back a long way. Now, Houthis are a family. It's not a tribe. And they're quite a well-known family in the northern part of Yemen and have always been held in high esteem. Back in, probably in the early 80s, they started a Shia, kind of a Zaydi Shia Renaissance movement called Believing Youth, which morphed over the time into an armed militia and armed insurgency. They really have grown very powerful. They are really clearly in a position to be able to conduct themselves in some ways as the government of Yemen, although they're not legitimate, they're not internationally recognized, but de facto, they have the authority, they have the power, they have the ability to conduct affairs as they choose to see them.
So the International Committee of the Red Cross is in the process of returning 700 Yemeni prisoners of war to their homes, part of a prisoner swap that's been months in the making. When we asked the ICRC about the prisoner swap we're talking about, a spokesperson told us that, quote, the ICRC was not part of the specific operation you referenced. Was the timing just a coincidence?
It may have been a coincidence. I also think that the ICRC was very careful in its statement to say that they were not involved in the operation does not mean, in my judgment, they were not involved in the negotiations. Mm. So the operation was conducted, again, between the Omanis and the Houthis. So the ICRC was not involved. They had no personnel on the ground. They did not do the actual mechanics of the operation. But I suspect the ICRC, knowing the way it works in these cases, does not wish to present itself as being the broker of this. And they probably did what they could to help facilitate this.
The Trump White House has managed to bring home a number of hostages. Is there any money being exchanged?
I don't know there's any money being exchanged. I haven't heard about that, and I haven't seen any evidence that that's the case. It could well be, but it's not been made public to my knowledge.
So with the U.S. so close to an election, do you see a political element to this hostage release?
Well, it's hard not to think there may be some. I mean, I don't know for sure, but it's interesting you asked the question because even Mohammed al-Houthi, who's one of the leadership figures in the Houthi insurgency, he seems to have our electoral timetable on his mind because he made a comment to the fact that this was supposed to happen some time ago, but the Americans dragged their feet in order to maximize the benefit to President Trump so close to Election Day. So at least in the eyes of some, the timing of this is quite interesting and suggests that there was a political element to it.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Stephen Sesh, speaking with us about the release of American hostages yesterday in Yemen. Ambassador, good to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Coronavirus cases across Europe are surging. That's led to new targeted restrictions in a number of countries aimed at avoiding blanket national lockdowns. In France last night, President Emmanuel Macron announced a nightly curfew for Paris and eight other cities.
Nous n'avons pas perdu le contrôle. Nous sommes dans une situation...
We have not lost control, Macron said on French TV. We are in a situation which is worrying and which means we shouldn't remain inactive, but we shouldn't panic. The curfew will go into effect Saturday and affects about a third of the French population. Catherine Hill is an epidemiologist in Paris who's been keeping close tabs on the epidemic there. What exactly is the theory and rationale for a lockdown? Why do officials say it's needed when they say we've got to have a lockdown?
Oh, it's the crisis in the hospitals. It's when the intensive care units are submerged that leads to lockdown. We're going to have a big problem here because the first lockdown was induced by a crisis in two zones in the country, in the east and around Paris. But now the virus is everywhere. In the first crisis, where they needed extra nurses, they brought in nurses from Marseille or from Brittany or from Bordeaux. But now we cannot do that because the crisis is everywhere. So it's going to be much more difficult.
So the curfew comes as most major cities in France have already been placed on maximum alert. Bars and gyms are closed, among other restrictions. Public transport is not affected, and travel between cities during daylight hours will continue. So how effective do you think these new measures will be? What will this curfew actually do?
I think it will have a very small effect. It will reduce a little bit the chance of contaminations at night, but most of the day activities will continue. And actually, we do not even know where people are contaminated in France. We don't know how many people are contaminated at any given time. So we're pretty much in the dark.
What do you think France should be doing instead?
My personal opinion is that they should consider massive testing and isolating whoever is positive. But massive testing requires a lot of tests, maybe antigenic tests that are a bit easier, PCR tests, or pool testing, which is done in some places, in universities in the US, for instance. I think it's something that has to be organized because the current system is so costly. I mean, we're losing so much money, closing bars, closing restaurants, having no tourists. I mean, it's just a major catastrophe.
So your take, Catherine Hill, is that curfews without testing, that's ineffective.
Yeah, it's really so marginal. And it's annoying a lot of people, starting with the people who have bars and restaurants who already have lost a lot of money.
So if testing is not widely available in France, doesn't that mean lockdown should be a measure that should be considered?
I think that we'll have to consider lockdown. But again, lockdown without testing is not very helpful. My analogy for lockdown is you have rotten meat in your refrigerator and you put it in the freezer. And then when it comes out, it starts rotting again. You know, lockdown just freezes things for a time. But we have been through that. We have seen the result. It calms down things for a while and then the virus starts spreading again. And that's where we are now. It calms things down for a while, but it's not the solution.
How is France's ICU capacity right now, and what does it look like going into colder temperatures?
The usual capacity before the crisis was 5,000, and they're saying that they have 12,000 beds. But this is maybe true as far as the beds are concerned, but an ICU bed without doctors and nurses is pretty much useless. And there are not enough doctors and nurses to staff the 12,000 beds. And also, right now, there are places where 65 of the ICU beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients, so the other patients are not getting care. So there's a big problem.
Catherine Hill is a French epidemiologist who's been monitoring the epidemic across France. Catherine, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
When the residents of Hawaii see the clock turn midnight tonight, the U.S. census count will grind to a halt. That's because of a new Supreme Court ruling this week. Census takers, though, say they haven't finished the job, in part because of delays caused by the coronavirus. An early end to the count will have a big impact on immigrant communities and communities of color. They've had a long history of being underreported in the census, which means their communities miss out on federal funding and congressional representation. Lisette Escobedo directs the National Census Program at NALEO, a nonprofit group working to civically engage Latinos. Lisette, the census is ending 2 weeks earlier than originally planned. Why does this matter?
2 weeks can mean a lot. We know that there's been a lot of confusion around the deadline. So there are a lot of folks in our community that actually have the October 31st as their final deadline because we promoted it when we got the ruling. That was the initial deadline that the Census Bureau had as well when they extended operations during COVID-19. Because of the shortening of the non-response follow-up process, we're pretty certain that the data that's being gathered is not accurate, it's not fair, and it's not just to our communities.
What is the reason for Latino communities in particular to be historically uncounted or undercounted?
There is a huge fear of sharing information, even things such as birthdays, such as how many people I have in my household. And so it does take a significant lift to try and get immigrant communities, undocumented communities to participate in the census. It takes trusted messengers. And so when you cut all of that short, it becomes particularly challenging. I mean, I had conversations with my grandma, who's a legal permanent resident, who didn't want to fill out the census because she felt that in some way her filling out the census was kind of alerting the government that she was trying to seek benefits in a time where there's an administration that is trying to not guarantee any type of benefits, even for legal permanent residents. And so you can only imagine for those community members who may not have access to anyone that can explain this to them, just how critical our outreach efforts and our outreach campaigns become in this work.
Lisette, when you think about how complex and chaotic this year's census has been, getting an accurate count with this looming, moving deadline, is there one story that you come back to?
You come back to really the power and the voice that young Latinos have in this country, because there were so many calls that we received to our national hotline where we had the grandma or the mom on the line, right? And our operators were explaining to them what are their response options, right? Online, et cetera. And you could always hear a young person, either that it's their son, their niece, their nephew, a family member that was younger. You know, you can hear them in the background helping them, right? And saying, oh, yeah, I heard that. You know, I'm typing it in the computer right now. You know, let me help you out. So it's really important to understand the important role that family members play in the civic engagement space. In general, folks say, you know, this process is very easy. You can do it in 5 minutes. You can do it in 10 minutes. It's understanding that our community is more complex than that, right? There's this sense that targeting Latinos is translating the commercial into Spanish, and that's just not how it works. And so it also took us working closely with the Bureau to look at their messaging and to figure out, you know, is this something that was translated to Latinos or is this something that's actually tailored to Latinos based on our attitudes, our messaging research? You really need to understand the Latino community to reach them, to have a trusted message, to understand that their trusted messengers are not always monolingual Spanish speakers.
Lisette Escobedo directs the National Census Program at NALEO, a nonprofit group working to civically engage Latinos. Lisette, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Just ahead on the program, Canada's far north is changing fast. How to keep tabs on the rapidly melting sea ice? There's an app for that. High tech to help people navigate their changing environments. That's coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is Thursday, which means it's time for The Big Fix, our weekly look at climate change solutions. Today, using technology to help communities adapt.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Canada's far north is one of the places changing most rapidly as our planet warms. That's having real impacts on how people live their day-to-day lives. The world's Anna Kusmer takes us to Nunavut to learn about a new app helping communities there.
If you go out on the sea ice in Nunavut, Canada's most northern territory, priority number one is not falling through. Making sure the ice you're traveling on is thick enough to support a snowmobile.
So let's say I'm going out on the sea ice, like going seal hunting.
Mick Apakook lives in St. Kilouac, one of Nunavut's hundreds of small islands that stretch deep into the Arctic.
I would assess the ice condition. I would get off my snowmobile and take my harpoon, walk a few meters where I think it's dangerous, and start punching through with the harpoon.
Driving a harpoon into sea ice is a traditional way to test its thickness. As an Inuk man, Apakook's been doing this his whole life, but now there's another step. If the ice is too thin, he grabs his phone and opens an app called Siku, which means sea ice in the language Inuktitut.
Take a photo and describe the ice conditions that you see. Once you get home, you can upload and tell other fellow hunters, this is the area to avoid.
A hunter going out the next day would open their app to a map of the north and its complex lines of jagged coast to see the thin ice warning that Apakook posted. The app launched last winter and has funding from private foundations, the federal government, and regional indigenous governments. Apakook says it was partly inspired by a recently deceased elder who wanted to merge old ways with new tech.
He said that it's time for the harpoon and the computer to work together. You meet two worlds. You meet the traditional way and the modern way in order to tell stories.
Apakook says he often goes out with elders to upload their observations on the app. One elder who makes frequent appearances is 73-year-old Jimmy Ekaluk, a sea ice expert. In a Siku post from February, he stands on a flat expanse as light snow whips around him. Speaking Inuktitut, Ekaluk points and says this year, the sea ice is different. Abnormally warm weather prevented the ice from getting thick enough. It may look safe, he says, but it's not. It's not just ice. Climate change is also affecting animal species important to the Inuit diet, like Arctic char and caribou. In the Siku app, people can post where they hunted snow geese, picked ripe berries, saw moose tracks, or caught fish. The app can be used by people to do real-time monitoring. But its founders hope it can also provide a long-term benefit, storing observations to help communities understand how things are changing in a region where that change is more rapid than almost anywhere else.
If you know about climate change in the Arctic, you know that the Arctic is warmer faster than the rest of the planet. Some science puts it at 2 times more than anywhere else.
Dennis Etiendum Delup operates another community-based app used to track wildlife in Nunavut. He says over time, the data gathered on Siku and his app can help communities make long-term decisions about where to hunt and where to have protected areas.
The Arctic is really in need of all of these programs, injecting new technology, monitoring sea ice, monitoring changing weather conditions, monitoring wildlife and patterns in the changes and things like this.
Before Siku, many people in the north would post their wildlife observations on Facebook, where the data no longer belongs to them. Joel Heath is one of the founders of the Siku app.
With Siku, you can download your own data, you own all your own intellectual property rights.
The app has over 6,000 users who have made thousands of observations.
It's really designed to respect Indigenous knowledge and allow full ownership, access, and control by the users.
Candace Peterson's job is to help Inuit communities all over Nunavut learn to use the app. She says they're also working on getting the app translated into different dialects of Inuktitut, which is a challenge.
Basically, almost every community has their own dialect.
Right now, the app is mostly in dialects found in eastern Nunavut.
But we don't have really anything for Inuknuptun, which is kind of like western Nunavut. And we want to do some workshops to make sure that their dialect is incorporated into this app.
She says as an Inuk woman, she also wants Siku to expand beyond hunting to include other traditional skills like sewing and cooking.
I'm hoping that Siku will become the new Facebook.
A Facebook that keeps people in touch, not just with each other, but with the changing North. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
The Big Fix is our weekly look at solutions to climate change. We've got more Big Fix stories on our website, from indigenous land rights in Brazil to global migration, saving coral reefs, even poetry. All of that at theworld.org/Big Fix. Countries sign treaties all the time. Economic treaties, political ones, military. Not many agreements, though, that deal with the moon. This week, though, seven nations joined the United States signing on to the Artemis Accords. Jim Bridenstine is the administrator at NASA.
I am here today to talk about the future. A future that is peaceful, free of conflict, and one where humanity explores and develops the moon and Mars in harmony. Achieving this future will require both vision and action, which is why it's my pleasure to sign, on behalf of the United States of America, the Artemis Accords.
The Artemis Accords lay out standards for how countries should interact with each other in space. That includes transparency, conflict resolution, sharing scientific information, even how to sustainably extract resources. The name Artemis comes from a U.S.-led lunar exploration program that's hoping to send astronauts back to the moon in 4 years. Not everyone supports the Accords or the U.S. vision. The head of Russia's space program, Dmitry Rogozin, is an outspoken critic both of the Accords and America's Artemis moon program. That's Rogozin speaking to a Russian tabloid this summer. He was accusing the U.S. of framing the moon exploration project not as an international collaboration, but more a U.S.-led coalition, like NATO, one that Russia is not interested in joining. And the Accords themselves, Rogozin compared those to the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. So if you're hoping that international rivalries magically evaporate once you leave Earth orbit, yeah, that's not happening. You're listening to The World. The president says mail-in ballots can't be trusted. The military does it and says the key is planning.
So you have to ask for the ballot. You have to ask in time to then get the ballot in time, to fill it out in time, and mail it in time.
It also takes time to count the ballots. That retired general warns, don't rush. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. Influence operations, cyber attacks, email hacking, all part of the Kremlin's playbook on fueling political discord abroad. Yesterday, Norway accused Russia of hacking into its parliament's email system this past summer. Russia calls Norway's accusation a provocation. Reporter Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. So have we learned anything new about this alleged cyber attack, Charles? Is there new evidence or any more information?
You know, Marco, frankly, not a lot, except for the media interest, of course, particularly since Norway decided to confront Russia publicly about this. We've got the foreign minister calling this a serious incident that affects our most important democratic institution. Also, Prime Minister Erna Solberg said this was a message to Russians they were sending, that this was unacceptable, and calling them out as being behind what she called this burglary.
One response from Russian officials, as I said, this is a provocation. So a provocation for what? What else are you hearing from the Kremlin?
Well, you know, that might sound a little bit familiar. It's kind of a shrug. The Russian embassy in Oslo said there was no evidence of this. But, you know, they made this point that Russia constantly faces cyber attacks, but that Moscow doesn't go publicly accusing other countries because they can't prove it.
So this happened in August, but Norway is just announcing it now in the middle of October. How do you explain the timing of the announcement?
Well, it certainly seems to be this latest example of a trend in souring relations between Oslo and Moscow. It seems to follow several espionage cases. For example, in August, Norway expelled a Russian diplomat on charges of spying, which led to the expulsion of a Norwegian diplomat in a tit-for-tat move. You know, then there was the conviction of a Norwegian border guard who was, in fact, caught spying on Russia in an embarrassment to the Norwegian security services. And he was sentenced to 14 years in prison before being later exchanged in a spy swap in November of last year. So you can see this pattern of back and forth between the two sides.
Mm. If true, what could Russia accomplish with a cyber attack like this, hacking into Norway's parliamentary email system?
You know, the truth is, Marco, we really can only guess. But it does come after a summer report by the Norwegian Defense Ministry that accused Russia of carrying out disinformation campaigns designed to undermine Norwegians' faith in their government, elections, government institutions. You know, the impact of that effort is a source of debate in Norway, as it is in many countries, of course, including the U.S., where we've seen similar accusations hurled at Russia.
Right. What is Russia's relationship like with Norway, both politically and on the military side?
You know, it used to have a pretty good relationship. That was really transformed, however, by Russia's annexation of Crimea back in 2014. You know, it prompted real concerns over Norway's territorial integrity. Could it protect itself from Russia? Then there's Norway hosting its fellow NATO members for a massive exercise in 2018 called Trident Juncture. You know, that simulated a response to an invasion of Norway by an unnamed enemy. But I was there and everybody understood the threat was Russia. And in fact, it's NATO's increased presence in Norway, combined with this support for civil society in northwest Russia, that's, you know, fed a lot of the Russian hostility. And that's a key point that Julie Williamson, this is a Russia analyst with the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, made to me when I spoke to her about the latest hacking charges. Her response, not surprised.
Norwegian-Russian relations have deteriorated since the crisis in Ukraine. If you look at Russian official statements, Norway really is seen as this general Western actor, which is waging a war on Russia.
So essentially, you know, Norway is seen by Russia as kind of the spearhead of NATO and also interfering with its own policies in Russia, supporting civil society, which Russia sees as basically backing what they like to call colored revolutions, street revolutions against the Russian government.
So, of course, Norway and Russia share a border, Charles. How does that play into bilateral relations?
Well, it's true. They share a 125-mile border up in the Arctic Circle. What's interesting is relations there are actually, you know, pardon the pun, but quite warm. Their neighbors and locals there on both sides of the border will tell you that they don't agree with these hostile relations that they see between their governments in Oslo and Moscow. But the fact is they're facing in the Arctic, it's become a theater for militarization, big defense buildups, and of course, competing trade interests between Russia, Norway, and NATO.
So back to the cyber attack. We've seen these types of attacks perpetrated by Russia on the U.S., on France, many other countries in the past. It's been going on for years. Aside from condemning them, is there anything that can be done to deter this kind of behavior?
Well, of course, there's cyber defenses. Norway, like the U.S. and other countries, has their own cyber command, and that, in fact, helped ID this latest attack. Tech companies are, of course, playing a big role in identifying malicious actors, arguably not enough. And for the rest of us, tech literacy matters. But in terms of deterring behavior, you know, there's going on the cyber offensive, of course. Also sanctions, particularly relevant here, given that Russia has been under constant sanctions over its actions in Ukraine, Syria, the 2016 elections in the U.S. And, you know, even today, the EU approved new sanctions targeting Kremlin figures over the poisoning of opposition politician Alexei Navalny last month. I have to say that though being in Russia, the danger here is it all gets kind of blurred together. I don't think at this point most Russians just see the automatic response of Western countries is to sanction Russia, and it doesn't seem to matter to them that much at this point.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
You've probably noticed that the news cycle here in the U.S. is moving at a breathtaking pace. But consider the pace of things in the former Soviet state of Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. 10 days ago, just after the country held parliamentary elections, protesters took to the streets, accusing officials of corruption and rigging the vote. A day later, protesters stormed the parliament building. And then Kyrgyzstan's Central Election Commission annulled the results of the vote, and scores of officials stepped down, including the prime minister. Then this happened. Kyrgyzstan's president declared a state of emergency in the capital, Bishkek. That all brings us to today, when in a written statement, Kyrgyzstan's president, Sooronbay Jeenbekov, said he is also resigning from office, apparently after feeling some serious pressure from the newly appointed prime minister. Protesters threatened to storm the presidential compound if Jeenbekov did not step down. Once news spread today of the president's resignation, activists in Bishkek celebrated. In a statement, Jeenbekov said he feared violence might break out if protesters actually followed through on their threat to march into his compound. He said, "I do not want to go down in Kyrgyzstan's history as a president who shed blood and shot at his own citizens." So, after all this, what's the situation in Kyrgyzstan? A nation grasping for some stability and wondering who is officially in charge. In his statement, the outgoing president called on the new prime minister and other politicians to get their supporters off the streets and bring peaceful life back to the people of Bishkek. Today, as we continue our global coverage of the U.S. election, a story about the biggest and oldest group of mail-in voters.
The whole world is watching.
The most important election.
Human rights.
Climate change.
Race. Immigration.
Value your freedom and democracy. This is what inspires the whole world.
President Trump has demanded that the winner of the 2020 election be named on election night. A group of retired U.S. generals and veterans has come forward to say that could disenfranchise military personnel on active duty and their families. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
Members of the military have voted by mail since the Civil War, but it's taken time to work out the process.
So you have to ask in time to then get the ballot in time, to fill it out in time, and mail it in time for it to be counted. That's not always as easy as people think.
General Wesley Clark learned that nearly 50 years ago when he was stationed in Germany and got his first absentee ballot.
It was like 3 feet wide and 4 feet long. You had to punch holes and you had to sign it in three or four different places. You had to stick it in another envelope, sign the other envelope. It was a complicated operation that I tried to do between 10 p.m. and midnight one night.
He doesn't know if that vote ever got counted. And Clark says there's still a degree of uncertainty about voting for the 172,000 active duty service members abroad. That's why he and other retired generals and veterans have banded together to create a new nonpartisan effort called Count Every Hero. It's not fraud they're worried about. And despite changes with the postal system that may slow mail, that's not their concern either. Retired Navy General Steve Abbott is co-chair of Count Every Hero.
I've been voting absentee most of my life, and my evaluation of the performance of the absentee and mail-in balloting in this country is that it works remarkably well.
It works well, but slowly for military members. A report to Congress about the 2018 election found that most military ballots received by election officials were counted, but about 6% were rejected, often because they were received after the deadline. David Becker is executive director of the nonpartisan nonprofit Center for Election Innovation and Research in D.C. He says military members have to navigate a complex web of federal and state laws. Many are stationed in far-flung locations, and most send their votes in by physical mail. Becker says it can take as long as 36 days for some soldiers to request a ballot, get one, send it back, and have it received by a state.
So this is exactly why election night doesn't exist. There is no such thing as election night in the United States.
He says federal laws require states to give military voters a grace period to get ballots in after election day. So Becker says results are always partial on election night. Military ballots could decide the election depending on how many votes separate candidates.
Anyone who insists that we set an artificial cutoff of midnight on election night is essentially disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of military voters overseas.
That's why it's important for veterans to speak out now, says Navy vet Todd Connor, who lives in the Chicago area, where he helps other veterans start businesses.
It's important now because I think we're hearing national leaders, the president in particular, kind of undermine the election process and sort of cast doubt on the integrity of the process.
Members of the military are supposed to serve without regard to politics, he says. So voting is the one way they can express their opinion. And Connor says that one way won't mean as much if, say, Trump claims he's won early on.
You know, it's like there's a fear that he will rush to judgment, call the election on election night, and that we wouldn't in the process allow military service members' votes to be counted.
That's why General Wesley Clark and others who were part of Count Every Hero say no winner should be declared until all military ballots are counted.
These are the very people who are putting their lives on the line to make sure every American has the right to vote. This is what our forefathers fought for and many of them died for. That's the real point of this whole effort.
He says people who protect a democracy should be able to trust that they can fully participate
in that democracy. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
How should colonial empires atone for past crimes? That was the question at the heart of a trial in Paris this week. Congolese activist Emery Mwazulu Diabanza avoided a jail sentence but was ordered to pay a fine. His crime, as French law sees it, Diabanza dislodged an African funeral pole from its display at a Paris museum, then attempted to carry it off the premises. He recorded the incident in June on a live stream. There you can hear Diabanza dislodging the funeral pole from its stand in the museum. He's saying, "We are leaving with what belongs to us. I've come to recuperate it from the Musée Quai Branly, and I am taking it to my house. It is a treasure that belongs to us." We're joined now by Diabanza's lawyer, Hakim Chergi. He's on the line from Paris. Hakim, what was your reaction to the verdict? Your client received a fine, but no jail time. Is this a victory?
Non, ce n'est pas une victoire parce que le jugement tel qu'il a été rendu.
No, it's not. It's not a victory because the verdict as given poses a problem, because it considers that an act of simulated theft is essentially an attempted theft.
Tout le monde sait que les activistes.
Everyone knows that the activists entered a museum to create a happening so that they would be noticed. They paid to go into the museum. They did it in bright daylight. They acted in front of the security officers and before the cameras. They acted with their faces uncovered. They did it merely as a staged event so that the entire world would grasp the importance of the issues of the theft and restitution of African cultural property.
So what message do you think this trial, the verdict, sends to the world about how we should reckon with past colonialism and racism and injustice?
Moi, le message qui me semble le plus important à transmettre.
To me, it seems that the most important message to communicate is that in order to put a stop to, or rather repair the inequalities of the past, well, we must first repair the inequalities of the past in order to right the wrongs of the present.
Les inégalités du passé pour redresser les torts du présent. La stèle funéraire qui a été volée, qui vient
du Tchad. The funeral pole that was stolen, which comes from Chad. For the inhabitants of Chad, it holds the soul of a deceased person. And as long as it doesn't rest in the earth, the dead one's soul inside the statuette cannot rest in peace. For the French who exhibit this statuette and charge for the visit, thereby financially exploiting the visit, for them, it's just a piece of wood that is a cultural item that comes from far away. But for Africans, it's the soul of a human that is between heaven and earth. So there's a difference in understanding that poses a problem, and that is truly the continuation of colonialism that people suffer from today. And I believe that the primary message is that we should, all of us, Africans, Europeans, Westerners, look at our history together and look it right in the face. There have been crimes committed. There have been abuses. There have been rapes. There have been thefts. Everything's been done. But we can repair this and move on. Except that today, France doesn't want to do it.
I'm curious, if this incident at the Musée Quai Branly had happened 20 years ago, how do you think the French justice system, French society, would have reacted?
Thank you for that question, because it's extremely pertinent. If this were 20 years ago, he would have gone to prison. Very simply, 20 years ago, the dominant class in France that was in charge of the institutions, that was in power, was of an age that had generally been familiar with decolonization. And notably, and this is very important to understand for the French, the Algerian War. The Algerian War, up until today, is a national cultural trauma, and that's all the more true because there's a very strong Algerian community in France. 20 years ago, the mentality was such that you would have never found a judge, and even less a president of the court, who would have said, as the president did, that there is no problem talking about France-Africa. There is no problem talking about colonialism. 20 years ago, they could have never said that. So there is an evolution in our mentality on such questions. We aren't there yet, but it will come. But today's generation has decided not to wait any longer, and that's fundamentally why they take actions that may appear shocking, such as seizing a statuette in a museum.
s'emparer d'une statuette dans un musée. Ils franchissent les limites aujourd'hui.
They're crossing limits today simply to express the fact that they won't wait any longer.
Hakim Shergi is a lawyer who represented Congolese activist Mwazulu Diabanza, who stood trial for attempting to steal an African artifact from a Paris museum. Hakim, thank you very much for your time and for explaining this to us.
You're welcome.
In the race to develop vaccines and treatments for COVID-19, there have been some recent hiccups. On Monday, Johnson & Johnson announced it had halted a large-scale trial of its COVID vaccine candidate. U.S. testing of a vaccine being developed by AstraZeneca is still on hold after that trial was paused last month. For more on what all these pauses mean, let me turn to Polly Roy. She's a professor and chair of virology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She joins us from London. Professor Roy, let's take the announcement this week from Johnson & Johnson, which concerned a vaccine trial. What's your reading of what happened there?
Well, for any vaccine, large scale, some people will react. It is actually normal, and it should show the vaccine is working. And it is good that they pause and trying to find out exactly what is the reason. And it could be for any reason. So it's not necessarily direct fault of the vaccine itself.
What about AstraZeneca's pause of its clinical trial?
It's the same issue. It's the same issue because they did a large scale also very carefully, step by step, and very transparent. And exactly same thing happened. So I don't find that is a real issue, really.
So there is still a lot of vaccine skepticism out there. How do you get over that while all these hiccups are happening along the way, which you say are totally normal?
It's totally normal. If you did not have any hiccup, that means your vaccine may not be really that good. It's not really working. It will have a different reaction to different people. Main thing is probably the majority of people will not have any reaction.
Professor Roy, as a scientist, what do you want the public to better understand when it comes to these vaccine trials?
You have to convince them that how we got the vaccine so good in smallpox, for example, or yellow fever. Of course, initially, it was a problem to convince people. They have to understand these fundamental issues. Vaccine is the key for stop any infectious disease. And this is the time we can make it safe vaccine, definitely, because the science is so advanced. And that's the key message everybody should understand. But it is better to go step by step with transparent knowledge for everybody, understand what's going on, to educate people why we need vaccine properly. And if you can explain each vaccine, what type they are, what danger they could be, people will understand. Not everybody have to be scientists, but scientists have to make others understood how each vaccines are working and whether they do any harm in their body or not, whether they have any feature effect or not. But the main goal is all these vaccines are trying to make strong antibody without making too much side effect. That is the idea that we have. But you cannot rush this sort of thing. You have to test with many people.
As far as a timeline for a vaccine, do you see perhaps a strong candidate is released and then maybe gets adjusted along the way, perhaps leading to a better vaccine or maybe a booster?
Yes, because that's the case for most of the vaccines. They start with think about polio the same way, polio vaccine, because you studied what is the best available that time. And then you improve with a different design because you're learning every day. Once they do all this trial, we will know what is happening side effect and what should we avoid.
Polly Roy is a professor and chair of virology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She's been speaking with us from London. Professor Roy, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
We've seen how the pandemic has been especially cruel on older people. That includes a group that's already lived through extraordinary suffering, Holocaust survivors. Germany says it will now pay more than $600 million to them, aid specifically for Holocaust survivors on the poverty line who are now trying to cope with a deadly disease. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
Germany has been paying reparations to Holocaust survivors for nearly 70 years. It's paid out more than $80 billion, and that amount is about to get higher. Gideon Taylor of the Claims Conference, which negotiates with Germany on behalf of survivors, says the coronavirus poses unique challenges to Holocaust survivors.
Suddenly, this global pandemic came and brought back difficult, complicated, hard memories of hard times.
The German government has agreed to give survivors an extra $500 million over the next 2 years. The funds will go to survivors who aren't already getting pensions from the German government, people who have mostly been left out of reparations agreements.
People who fled and escaped from the Nazis, often just before the Nazis came. Many of them went to the east of the former Soviet Union. Many of them are what we call double victims, victims of the Nazis, and then after the war, victims of communism. And some of them live still in the Soviet Union, many of them, but also in the United States here.
Most people don't know this, but the German government and the Claims Conference meet every year, even when there's not a pandemic, to increase reparations and expand the circle of survivors who qualify for them. Gideon Taylor says both sides come to the negotiating table with pretty much the same goal, to help as many survivors as they can while they're still alive.
Even despite all the distance in time from the Holocaust, even despite the political changes in Europe generally politically, there's still that core understanding that this is a responsibility.
It's not a sentiment that's lost on Holocaust survivors.
The German government, it does this voluntarily.
This survivor is close to my heart. It's my grandfather, Jack Rosenthal.
They are doing it as an independent country. In German, it's called Wiedergutmachung, trying to do the right thing, sort of.
And Jack appreciates it, but it's complicated. He gets two payments from the German government, reparation for his time in Auschwitz and Buchenwald concentration camps, and a Social Security pension for work he did in the ghetto where his family was forced to live. But he sees it sort of like blood money.
I put it in for a charity. I don't want to touch their money.
I asked him about the new payments, if he thinks the German government should be helping survivors affected by COVID.
I don't think the coronavirus has anything to do with the Holocaust. But on the other hand, I think the German people are responsible for all the survivors, for their well-being.
Gideon Taylor says it's not just about the money. It's about honoring the people who help us find strength.
Those Holocaust survivors are the heroes for us today. And we have living among us people who went through the unimaginable and then came back and rebuilt their lives.
They remind us that resilience is possible. A reminder we always need, but especially in a pandemic. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
That's our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.